So now, in 90 AD at the Council of Jamnia, when the rabbis canonized writings, there was already evidence that the what we call the law, the Torah, and the prophets and the Psalms were pretty much accepted as the Jewish Bible. We find that even in the book of in the Gospel of Luke. At Jamnia, the book of the prophet Ezekiel was decided to contradict the legality and priesthood of the Pentateuch, but it had sufficient weight of acceptance to be included in the canon. So Ezekiel was an iffy book with them. The Song of Songs was very stiffly opposed, but finally was included with a notation that no Jew under 30 years of age was to read it. That's because it was a mystical book, and it was full of allegories that only rabbis who were deeply trained and of a certain mature years could understand, because it had to do with mystical practices. The book of Esther was opposed, and also the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, Hillel had been in favor of Ecclesiastes, and Shammai was opposed to Ecclesiastes in their schools. But both of these books, because of their popular acceptance, even in spite of their theological content, or lack of thereof, finally forced them into the canon. And we have the Torah, the law, the prophets, which include Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 prophets, and what are called just the writings, which are the Psalms and the Proverbs, etc. But it's instructive to look at what was left out. There were oracles by Jeremiah that were originally written to have been read in the presence of the king, and the king burned them and rewrote them, adding more prophecies, etc. So that's how those books were actually written by a single prophet. There are many others that were available that were not included in the canon that we find mentioned in the literature. The Book of Jashar, the Wars of Yahweh, Omri and Ahab, and as it says, but are not their acts written in the book of the kings of Israel, and so on. And there are teachings in many of these things that contradict the teachings of the other books. The writer of the Book of Chronicles tries to leave out all the bad things about King David and portray him as the actual organizer of the temple. There are many, many contradictions of all kinds of things, as opposed to what some of the other chroniclers have to say. Now, many of the books that you will find in the other Bible, pseudepigraphical books like the Psalms of Solomon, the Testament of Job, the Book of Enoch, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, and so on, are known as the pseudepigrapha. They are apocalyptic literature. They are literature that is written between the periods of the classic Old Testament and the New Testament, the period that connects Judaism and Christianity. And that was a period of a great apocalyptic movement. The thing that had happened is that while the priesthood of the Jews was living in exile, but actually rather happy exile, in a very collegial relationship with the priesthood of the Babylonians, and learning a lot and interchanging a lot and making a lot of dialogue and so on, they were introduced to the whole business of astronomy and astrology in a way that had never existed before. That's indicated in the writing that they do, they put together of the story of creation, where they say that the stars are given for signs in the sky. And astrologers very correctly quote that as a biblical endorsement of astrology. Because the Babylonians were experts at astrology and astronomy, and much of what they had rubbed off on the Hebrew priesthood, and it was adopted by them. And one of the things that became a worldwide concern was the fact that in springtime, the sun was no longer appearing at the equinox to be in the constellation of Aries, where it belonged. Aries was, of course, the first house and the first constellation of the zodiac. But somehow, over hundreds and thousands maybe of years, the sun was rolling backwards. Somehow the earth was rolling off its moorings, and the sun was starting to appear in the sign of Pisces. This is what we mean by the age of Aries and the age of Pisces. And so the response to that was, well, something very cosmic is happening. Something very cataclysmic is happening. The end of the world is at hand. God will end the world in fire was one of the great kinds of ideas that was going around. There will be a new heavens and a new earth. These apocalyptic ideas that came from Isaiah and went on and are quoted almost directly again in the Apocalypse of John and so on are part of this whole apocalyptic era. And the apocalypse means that which is hidden, and it's a revealing of hidden things. But the apocalyptic literature took as a premise that there were the secrets of heaven and earth, there were times, there were seasons, there was an evolution, there was new age coming into being, etc. It was a time very much like now when people are talking about a new age and a new kind of thing in the history of humanity. That led into the whole messianic business. And as astrologically the world rolled into the age of Pisces, the Piscean age, which and now it's rolling into the age of Aquarius, the Aquarian age, there was much speculation about cosmic events and what God had in store for people. So people who were mystics and who were mystic prophets and prophetic mystics took special flights in a sense in meditation up to the throne of God to learn the secrets of God and of the angels and so on. And it's at this point that we hear the development of angels. We first meet the character of Shaitan or Satan and Lucifer, and you start to hear the names of angels, and angels appear in Jewish literature quite commonly. They don't appear earlier. Earlier we have cherubim and seraphim, or the serpents and so on that surround the throne of God, but we don't have angels. And Satan in this period is a prince of heaven, but sometime during this period Satan falls and becomes a fallen being and a tempter of men and separated from God and separated from heaven, celebrated in some of the apocalyptic literature and much later in Milton's Paradise Lost and so on. These all reflect things that are going on inside of humanity and the developments that are going on inside of humanity and the spiritual developments. If we were to look at Eastern and Western religion at this point, the time of the development of Jewish religion as a religion of the book, time of the returning exiles in the 5th century B.C., we have the time of Buddha, Gautama Buddha, and the teachings of the Hinayana school, the old vessel. At the time of Jesus, we have the development of Mahayana Buddhism and the idea of the Bodhisattva, who gives up his well-earned right to pass out of this world and this existence into nirvana in order to stay to help every sentient being achieve liberation. And this is very much the same ideal as the Christ ideal and the ideal of the saints, the Christian saints. Christian sainthood comes out of Jewish sainthood. The ideas of sainthood and saints that after their death help human beings and can be appealed to, etc., is originally Jewish, and you'll find a lot of these ideas in the apocalyptic literature. In fact, a great deal of what you think of as Christianity is really in this literature from around 200 BC to the time of Jesus. And there are even legendary characters like the Teacher of Righteousness in the Qumran documents, the Dead Sea Scroll documents, who are very much similar to the the suffering Messiah. There are ideas of different kinds of Messiah. A Messiah Ben David, the son of David, who will come in victory, political victory, to overcome all the enemies of Israel and restore the nation of Israel. And then there's a Messiah Ben Joseph, who will suffer, who will come and suffer and die. And there are many stories about these different messiahs and these different ideas and expectations. And in the New Testament, Jesus refutes some of the ideas about the Messiah. He says, why do you say the Messiah is the son of David? When David himself calls him Lord, etc. So Jesus was an advocate of the Messiah Ben Joseph, the suffering Messiah, etc., the mystical Messiah, the wise Messiah. And at this point, we should hasten to add that Jesus never presented himself as a Messiah. He talked about the coming of the Son of Man, which is, or the Son of Mankind, which was a messianic figure that was spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Jesus actually was an advocate of the coming of the Messiah and did not declare himself as a Messiah or to be a Messiah, and looked forward to the coming of the Messiah. And much of what he did was in the way of messianic banquet, the Eucharist, the liturgies, and so on. In Gentile Christianity, that became the idea of the second coming of Christ, meaning Jesus, in glory, whereas the first time was in crucifixion and so on. But the teachings of Jesus about the Messiah were very coherent with existing messianic teachings. It was an expectation of a Messiah, which, or we might say, a new humanity, because he's a collective figure. So it's an anticipation of a new age and of a new humanity and of things like this that then gets put by Gentile Christianity into the format of the person of Jesus, who is the Christ, who is the Messiah, Christos Messiah. And then this strange idea of the second coming of Christ becomes grafted into Gentile Christianity as their way of understanding the teachings of Jesus about the coming of the Messiah. So Jesus would probably, if he were in this room and talking to us, would probably say, the Jews are right, the Messiah hasn't come yet, and we are awaiting the coming of this Messiah. But what kind of a figure, what kind of a person, what Jesus represented as a divine event among humans, well, the very brilliant thing about Gentile Christianity was to identify that and the imitation of Jesus, the imitation of Christ, the imitatio Christi, is all part of the genius of Gentile Christianity. There is also a New Testament apocrypha, and not a pseudepigrapha, but just an apocrypha. The Old Testament has an apocrypha and a pseudepigrapha, because part of it is written under the names of people like Solomon and Enoch and so on. Whereas in the New Testament, Gospels and Epistles and all kinds of other things that were not included in our New Testament today are called apocryphal literature. They were mostly produced in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. You'll find some of those in your text on the other Bible. We will discuss some of those later. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about textual criticism and some of the problems with the texts of the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament. We're talking specifically about the Old Testament now. Basically, we have a northern tradition of manuscripts that are copied down to about the time of Zechariah, which is 400 BC, and then a southern tradition of manuscripts that are copied about down to about 250 BC. And Greek translations of these, and Hebrew texts of these, and then texts that start to be turned into Aramaic. Hebrew and Aramaic are the same alphabet and very similar languages, but the native language of the Hebrews turns to Aramaic a couple of centuries before the time of Jesus. And it's still written with the same alphabet, and it's very similar to the same language. It's sort of like the difference between Chaucer's English and modern English. So we have three languages that we can talk about here. We can talk about Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. Now, there are some problems raised by the vocalization of the Hebrew text because Hebrew is written all in consonants, no vowels. And the vowels are just memorized. People memorize how you say them. For example, if I write something like Godisnowhere, how is it going to be said? It's going to be say, am I going to say God is now here or God is nowhere? You don't know unless you know what the trick is to it. And this is the problem with Hebrew, is there's no vocalization. The whole system of vowels is invented much later in the transmission of it, and so we rely upon oral traditions about how things are translated. For example, in Psalm 73, according to the Christian numbering, not the Jewish numbering, which is one number different, one reading of the unvocalized text could be, and afterward receive me to glory, or, and afterward lead me by the hand. So you see there's a lot of differences in how that can be done. Now the scribes washed their hands each time before they transcribed the holy name to refresh his mind and avoid the danger of omission or repetition. Repetition is called dittography. And if an error was found in a scribe's manuscript, the entire page was destroyed. If the middle word or letter of a text was known, or the number of words in a text known, or the number of passages beginning with certain words were known, these were counted. You count the number of letters on your page, count the number of lines beginning with this letter, etc. There are all kinds of things. Now, there are, for example, we can find many differences between the Isaiah scroll written about 100 BC in Qumran, and the Masoretic text of Isaiah that is part of our standard scripture, which was actually put together, and we can date back to about 900 AD. There are many differences as far as spelling and tenses, but there is absolutely no variation in meaning or theology. And the system that the Jews had and the Jewish scribes and the rabbis had for transmitting their literature without Xerox machines, but from person to person in schools, worked very well because the oral tradition kept the meaning intact in spite of all the kinds of errors that could creep in. There are words that can be translated into a language like English that have so many different kinds of meanings that the translation from one language to another can be a terrible problem. Now, we can talk about the texts and versions of the Old Testament. The text is the original language. The version is a translation. A manuscript is a handwritten copy. Scrolls were of papyrus, which are now broken pieces, or vellum, which is animal skins, and these survive better. They average about 24 feet long, enough to contain the whole book of Isaiah. Scrolls were in vertical columns with a scroll held horizontally, so that the scroll could be cut into a codex and could be stitched together like a book. The first major witness to the Hebrew Old Testament is the Masoretic text. It became necessary for Jews to have a standardized text due to a decline of spoken Hebrew and the need for authority to counter Christian use of the Old Testament. From the 6th to the 10th centuries AD, the Masoretes, or scholars of the tradition, Masorah, continued the process of copying, comparing texts, vocalizing. Now, they added a system of vowels to show how the vowels would be, and preserving variant readings. And gradually, a canon was established. There were three systems: the Palestinian system, where they used a supralinear stroke above the line to create vowels; the Babylonian system, where they wrote these vocalizations sideways above the words; and the Tiberian system, which is the one we use today. It's written below the Hebrew consonants, little symbols for the vowels. Um, Also the sacred name of God, YHWH, as vowels, as consonants rather, was never pronounced. The only person who could pronounce the sacred name of God was the high priest one day of the year in the Holy of Holies. And the person who knew later on in Kabbalistic times, the only people who knew how to pronounce the divine name were called masters of the divine name. The Baal Shem Tov, the Lord of the good name. And that's what only the high priests of Israel knew. And the name was pronounced in a way that was very sacred. And we know today from research that the name is probably very close to the word Yahweh. And we know that it was probably sung in a way like this. I won't sing it for you because being a master of the divine name, if I say it, the entire world would end if I say it the right way, so I better not tell you. But the name of the Tetragrammaton, the name that would be translated as Yahweh, was never done so. It was always written in English versions as capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, the Lord. And in the synagogues, it was the word Adonai, Lord, was substituted for it. And when they took the vocalization of Adonai, A-O-I, and put it with those consonants, it came out Jehovah. And so Jehovah was the word that the Puritans used and the Pilgrims and the Protestants and so on used as the name of God. But that's actually two names. That's the consonants for the Tetragrammaton, the YHWH, and the vowels for Adonai put together, Jehovah. Well, of course, Hebrews and the Jews never say Jehovah. They say Adonai or Adonoi. And no one tries to pronounce the sacred name of God. Now, the Samaritans had a text of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, which were the only ones they considered to be the real Bible. And it was held by as of many years ago by the modern Samaritan high priest in Nablus. I told you that his grandson and successor at that time was mentally unstable due to the strict intermarriage practiced by the remaining 209 or so Samaritans. They are sort of coddled by the government and thrive on tourism and charge money to be photographed, etc. But it's written in old Hebrew characters with about 6,000 differences in text and everything else from the Masoretic text, 2,000 of which agree with the Greek Pentateuch, the Greek version of the Old Testament, which is much older than the Masoretic text, physically older. And they, of course, the Samaritans, claim it to be the one written by Moses. It is very ancient, the text they have. And their tradition dates from the 5th to the 4th centuries B.C., back to Ezra and Nehemiah, who required the marriages of people who had remained in the land and not been taken captive. Those people had to divorce their lower caste wives and intermarry with the Jewish royalty and the pure Jews, etc. The Samaritans moved to the north of the city and they copied the Jerusalem scripture from the temple and set up their own temple in Samaria. So that's one of the very old versions that we have. But their method of transmission may not have been anywhere near as good as that of the rabbis. And then there's the versions like the Septuagint, the LXX. About 250 BC, the Pentateuch was translated for the Hellenistic Jewish community in Alexandria. And the rest of the books were translated continuously up to about 100 B.C. The tradition is that the Library of Alexandria invited 6 scribes from each tribe to sit in separate chambers and translate the entire thing, and the 72 came up with it all exactly the same translation. This became shortened as to the 70 or the LXX or the Septuagint, as it is known in Hebrew. There are also other versions by Aquila, Theodotion, Symmachus, Origins, Hexapla, and so on. And then there's just massive amounts of archaeological discoveries of the John Rylands Papyrus from 150 AD. That's Deuteronomy in Greek. and the Chester Beatty Papyri from the 2nd to 4th century, 8 Old Testament books, the Freer Manuscript, the Codex Vaticanus, the Codex Sinaiticus, all from the 4th century. Unfortunately, most of that codex was used by the monks to start fires, so we don't have as much of it as we'd like to. Of course, the Qumran manuscripts, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Isaiah being the most complete. And there are paraphrases of the Hebrew scriptures, the Aramaic Targums, were accepted paraphrases that were written down long after being established. Some of these things go back to the 5th century B.C. There's a Syriac Peshitta, which is the Bible of the Syriac Christians in Aramaic. The earliest extant version is from the 5th century A.D. Then there's the Latin Vulgate, a very old version of the translation into Latin done by St. Jerome under Pope Damasus, and he translated the existing Palestinian Hebrew into Latin at his time, and that became, by the year 404 AD, became what we call the Vulgate version, which is still used in the Roman Catholic Church. It's very interesting. The Vulgate was really clearly influenced by Christian theology. For example, Jesus' name is found in the Psalms whenever it's linguistically possible, and a whole lot of funny things like that. So when these people translate, they're doing it with a lot of theological tendencies. And then there are paraphrases in the Coptic and the Ethiopic and the Armenian and the Gothic and all kinds of things. There are also letters from places like Lachish, east of Jerusalem, in Proto-Hebraic, the Elephantine Papyri from the 4th century Jews, 4th century BC, living on an island in the Nile, writing to the temple after return from exile, seeking permission to build a temple for Yahweh and Anat, his consort, a Canaanite goddess, and they used a square script, and we have manuscripts there. There's a Nash Papyri from the 2nd century BC in Egypt, with the Ten Commandments and the Shema, and some of the earliest texts of the Old Testament besides what we have at Qumran. And the Jews, obviously, we can see from this, had not only scripture but collections that they used for liturgical purposes, something from the prophets, something from the Psalms, and so on. Two of the Isaiah scroll from Qumran show variant readings against each other, which does not seem to have bothered the Qumran Essenes. The better scroll seems to be like the Masoretic, and the worst is like the one preserved in the Septuagint, so it seems the Masoretic text is still pretty good. There are several other we can mention, the Samaritan Triglot and the Complutensian Polyglot and some others, but these are all texts that we have of the Old Testament that preserve it. And these texts differ from each other. The same verse, the same thing, will appear in many different versions, and textual criticism is applied. We want to go for the oldest, and then we have two or three variants that are equally old. If we can explain one as from some kind of process, like a process of vocalization or verbal misunderstanding, or if one of them is a pun and it obviously is supposed to be there and the other one was misunderstood, or whatever. Different ways we try to recover the earliest and most authentic text, and that's the work of lower criticism, lower biblical criticism, textual criticism. If you get yourself a Hebrew Bible, you will see, if you get a scholarly version, you will see that there are footnotes, just thousands of footnotes with all kinds of arcane little abbreviations that refer to the different manuscripts, and the scholar's best guess as to what the earliest one was and why it was there is put there, but the other variants are also shown, so you can see. So when you read a Bible, any Bible that's done by scholars and it's done in the original language like Hebrew or like Greek for the New Testament, we'll have a whole set of codes and footnotes showing all the other possible readings of the very same sentence from all these different manuscripts, and showing those that the editors and the scholars think are most likely. So that's the issue of textual criticism. You want to get the most accurate Old Testament and New Testament. You want to get one made by scholars. These are available. Most modern Bibles are done by scholars that do this sort of work. And they don't have a lot of footnotes. They might just have one little thing. But if you get it in Greek or you get it in Hebrew and you study it, you will find all these annotations. And so that's the process of just trying to get an accurate historical text of a piece of ancient literature like this. So I hope you've gotten a kind of general overview of what the Old Testament is as literature from this and where the text comes from. In my next tape, I want to show you some of the sources of the Old Testament and how we reconstruct its history and where the Bible really came from. You can go to the next tape.